Hello and welcome to a responsive day for the 5th of Tishrei. Let's start by thanking Rabbi Jacob Bromwich, David Hochhauser, and the OU for hosting these shiurim on their website and for posting them for you. And my name is Gideon Rothstein, and today we're going to study a responsive of Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank was a Rav who was born in Kovno, Lithuania in 1874, who in 1893 immigrated to Israel. At the age of 19, that is, and it's before there was any mass aliyah. There was already some aliyot happening, but there were still, I think there were under 10,000 Jews in Eretz Israel at the time. But it is to me a reminder that we talk about like a time when Eretz Israel was completely inaccessible, and I think it's not always as true as we think it is. You know, we have stories going back, let's say, in the 1500s. Rav Yosef Karo wasn't born in Eretz Israel, but he moves there. The Vilna Gaon has students who move there, and the Vilna Gaon himself wanted to move there, and then something happened that stopped from doing so, but certainly he had students who moved there. So there have been these people who moved to Eretz Israel all along the way, and there's this famous response of Rav Yosef Karo's about people who would come to Eretz Israel just for Chagim. So it seems like the borders weren't quite as closed as people tend to think they were, but that's the history. In any case, Rav Yitzchak of Tzvi Pesach Frank moves to Eretz Yisrael, becomes an important rav there. He was put to the Dayan in the Beis Din in 1907, in the Beis Din of Rav Shmuel Salant, who was the Rav of Yerushalayim. He helped establish Chief Rabbi of Israel. He was part of having Rav Cook appointed the Chief Rabbi of Israel, and he himself was the Rabbi of Yerushalayim for decades, for a long, long time. And he passed away in 1960. So his Har Tzvi is a book of responsa. We don't always get a chance to see it. But for the 5th of Tishrei, he has a tshuva from Har Tzvi in Orech Chaim 2, responsa number 108, Kufchet. Let's get to know him a little bit better. And the question at hand was about the branches of a canary palm. So a canary palm is a kind of a palm tree. So it is, according to Wikipedia, native to the Canary Islands. It's a relative of the true date palm. It's the natural symbol of the Canary Island. And it's got very small, oval yellow to orange fruit with one single large seed in it. And the Wikipedia says the fruit pulp is edible but too thin to be worth eating. And the question that Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank is going to deal with is this canary palm, is this the branches of it able to be considered a lulav, right? Because we today think of a lulav as palm branches. So could this palm frond, I think is the word, could this be used for lulav? The problem is the fruit. If the fruit is so small and it's not worth eating, the way the Torah describes this branch is as kapot tamarim, which is the branches of a date tree. So the question is the canary palm a date tree? It's true that it's considered the canary date palm, but the date doesn't really qualify as a date because it's not really a fruit. So the rabbi, turning to Rabbi Frank, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, wanted to know, do the branches of the canary palm qualify as a lulav? So his first instinct was, he suggested that when the Torah says kapot tamarim, it doesn't mean that every tree in the that's going to produce these branches has to have dates on it, just has to have fruit on it. It's that this is a type of tree that has fruits on it. So, for example, he says, if you look at tefillin, the Gemara in Shabbat 28b, Chafed Amid Bet, says that when you're going to write tefillin, you have to write it on the hide of a kosher animal. Right, tefillin are written on leather, on hides, on parchment, not leather, but on parchment, which comes from the hide of an animal. So it has to be the hide of a kosher animal. And you get that because the Pasuk in Shmot, Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Tet, speaks about wearing tefillin, l'ma'an tiyat Torah Hashem b'ficha. So it has to be min haru'i l'ficha, it has to be from a kosher animal that you could theoretically eat, min hamutar b'ficha. Right? So then you might say to yourself, then tefillin has to be written on an animal that's actually kosher. But the fact is that we don't think that there's a problem with writing tefillin on animals that died without a proper shkita. That's called a nevela. A nevela is an animal that for it either just died on its own, or somebody killed it in a non-shkita way, or somebody tried to do shkita and something went wrong in the shkita. All those animals are called nevelot. Truth is, depending on what went wrong in the shkita, it might become a trefa. But one of those, it's either a nevela or a trefa, and we don't say, and those are not menamuta beficha themselves, you couldn't eat them because they're not kosher. But they're from the kind of an animal we could eat, and you would slaughter it properly, had you done a proper shkit on it. So therefore, they're okay, they qualify for tefillin. Says Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, when the Torah says kapot tamarim, I could have imagined that we meant from trees that are worthy of having tamarim in them, not trees that actually themselves have have dates in them, have tamarim on them. Now that raises an interesting question, because we treat the in the non-Jewish world would treat the canary palm as its own species, right? So I'm reading you from Wikipedia. Phoenix canariensis is a species of flowering plant in the palm family, Araceae. Native canariensis, it's a relative of Phoenix dactylifera, the true date palm. So even if Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank wanted to make his argument, he'd have to make two arguments. One question would be, let's say I have an actual date palm, an ordinary date palm, whatever the term was, a Phoenix dactylifera, the true date palm. And that particular true date palm didn't have any fruit on it. So then, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank's argument would be, okay, but when the Torah says kapot tamarim, it means the kind of a tree that has tamarim, not this actual tree has tamarim. That would be a perfectly fine argument. To apply that to the canary palm, as Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank is suggesting to begin with, we'll get there, but as to apply that here, you'd have to then say that this other kind of date palm is really the same kind of tree as that other one. There's nothing fundamentally different about them, and that's why the fact that many of them have dates on them, the ones that are the true date palm, would be enough to say that this can also be used as a lulav branch. That makes the parallel to a non-slaughtered animal not quite exact. Meaning, if I have two cows, one of which had a proper shkita, one of which didn't have a proper shkita, and I say the Torah tells me, mina mutar b'ficha, that which is permitted to your mouths, means that the type of animal is permitted to your mouths, because the two cows are fundamentally the same, even before they die. There, the two trees aren't quite fundamentally the same, unless Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank is assuming that no, the canary date palm is in fact a true date palm. There's nothing meaningfully different between them, and that's an odd thing, just because, at least in the scientific world, they don't see it that way. Doesn't mean it's impossible, but we'll have to address that later on. Besides that being his instinct, and whether or not that applies to canary date palm, he notes that the Chatam Sofer seemed to require that a lulav tree have dates. That was based on, the discussion was, there's a Madane Yom Tov. Madane Yom Tov is a commentary on the Rush by Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller, who's perhaps better known, at least according to Wikipedia, he's best known for writing a commentary on the Mishnah called the Tosfot Yom Tov. So in addition to the Tosfot Yom Tov, which is on Mishnah, he wrote a commentary on the Rush called the Madane Yom Tov. The Rush had ruled, and this is recorded in Shulchan Aruch in Yoredeh as well, that a palm or etrog tree that was planted to produce mitzvah items, produce, you know, lulavim or etrogim, you have to nonetheless give it 3 years of orla. So let's remember the obligation of orla is that when we plant a fruit tree, you can't use any of the fruit for the first 3 years. Theoretically, you could have said that when you plant a lulav tree or an etrog tree and your point is to use them for a mitzvah, then you're not really planting a fruit tree because you don't intend to use the fruit for anything other than mitzvah. Theoretically, you could have said that. And then if you said that, you might have argued that you don't have to wait the 3 years for the orla because it's not really a fruit tree. The Rush, however, paskin, then no. Since they're fruit trees, you have to wait 3 years for the orla, and you can't use them until then, until after the 3 years. The Madane Yom Tov, Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller, wondered about that, because the Yerushalmi that says this only speaks about etrog trees. So Madane Yom Tov, Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller said, the etrog is the fruit of the tree. So then it makes sense that even if we're going for a mitzvah purpose, it's still the fruit that we want, and therefore you can say it's still a fruit tree. You're planting the tree to get its fruit. It's true that when you get the fruit, your primary use of the fruit is going to be for mitzvot rather than for eating or for making jam or whatever it is, and therefore you might have thought it doesn't count as a fruit tree. So then the Yerushalmi tells me, no, it counts as a fruit tree because you're planning on using the fruit. That's what the Yerushalmi meant, says Rav Yosef Lipman Heller. But the Rosh is applying it to a palm tree. And a palm tree, what you want to use are the branches, not the fruit. So that, says the Madane Yom Tov, would seem to be more similar to a situation where you plant a tree for its wood. Granted, there are trees, let's say if I planted an orange tree, and what I wanted was the branch to use as firewood. Why I chose to plant an orange tree rather than other trees, I don't know. But let's say I did. Plant an orange tree because it'll grow quickly, or because I think it's hardy, or whatever the reasons are that I plant an orange tree. I'm planning to use it for its wood, so the halacha is that you don't have to wait the years of orla. So even the lulav to the lulav tree would seem to be the same thing, because what you want it for is the branches. So the Ramadan Yom Tov, and this is something to watch, because the Ramadan Yom Tov is right around the same time, it's a little bit after the Shulchan Aruch. But not enough after the Shulchan Aruch that he realizes this big rule that we're not allowed to argue with Rishonim, because the Ramadan Yom Tov is living in the late 1500s, early to mid 1600s. He passed away in 1654, so he's in the first or second generation right after the Shulchan Aruch. He's still willing to say, I think the Rosh got it wrong. I disagree with the Rosh. He's willing to argue with the Rosh still, and to say that he thinks that if you planted a tree purely for the sake of using its branches for mitzvah, for lulavim, then it's not going to be obligated in Orlan. You can use the branches right away. Chatham Sofer came to explain what the Rosh had been thinking, and trying to explain what the Rosh had been thinking, let us know something what he thought about the status and the type of tree that you needed for a lulav tree. The Torah speaks about kapot marim, says the Chatham Sofer, a branch of a date tree, and that makes having dates necessary to the definition of the lulav tree. This is what the Chatham Sofer is arguing. He wasn't talking about the canary palm. Whereas Tupasuk Frank is pointing out that if he wasn't talking about the canary palm, he nonetheless made a point that's relevant to the canary palm, which is that he thinks that the tree has to have fruit on it. And that would explain why the Rush would hold that you have to follow the laws of Orla. Because if it's necessary that the tree have fruit on it, then it's got to be a fruit tree, and then it's got to be obligated in the laws of Orla. If you're going to be able to plant the tree only for its trunk and branches, so then it's not a fruit tree. That's why the Orla doesn't follow the rules of Orla. But the Chatham Sofer, in order to qualify for the laws of Lulav, it has to be a date tree. And therefore, if you plant it for the mitzvah, it means you must mean it to have fruit. And therefore, it's a tree that's also planted for its fruit, because you need the fruit in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Lulav with this tree, and therefore be obligated in Orla. Rabbi Yosef Frank says that you don't have to read it that way. That's not the only way to read it, because when you plant a tree to wave it to Trogim on Sukkot, you're not going to eat them, but you still need the fruit itself. That's what makes it a fruit tree. But when you need a lulav tree to have fruit, it's not the same as making it into a fruit tree necessarily for orla purposes. There are lots of trees that have fruit, but that are grown for other purposes, and therefore, halakhically, they aren't for orla purposes, fruit trees. Right? And then there are also non-fruit trees that occasionally grow some kind of fruit. And we make a boy priya eats on those kind of fruit, but they don't have to go into the year. Also, the Tzibas of Frankens pointing out the Chatham Sofer's attempt to explain the Rush doesn't quite work, because just because you need a tree to have fruit does not necessarily make it a fruit tree. I would only point out that the Tzibas of Frankens could have also said, it seems to me, that another response to the Chatham Sofer could be that the Rush held not that this particular tree needs fruit, but that these kinds of trees need fruit, otherwise it doesn't qualify as a lulav tree, but that might be enough to obligate an orla, meaning theoretically the Rush could just mean that since I need this to be of a kind of fruit-bearing tree, then I need it to be in the category of fruit-bearing trees. And once I need it to be in the category of fruit-bearing trees, then it becomes an orla tree. So that when Tzibas Frank points out that if you plant a fruit tree halakhically for the wood and the branches, and that means you're not obligated in orla, that's because you don't care that it be part of that kind of tree. I could have argued against the Chazal of Yehuda. Chazal of seems to say that means you need to have this tree have fruit on it. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense that it be obligated on orla. But I could theoretically have said, no, maybe the Rush is arguing that you need these kinds of trees. Anyway, so you get into this complicated question of, does a lulav tree need to have fruit in order for you to be able to fulfill the mitzvah of lulav with that tree? So Rabbi Yosef Frank is suggesting that the Chatham Sofer's discussion of the Rush's perspective of Orla about this tree suggests that he thinks that in order for a lulav tree to be valid for lulav, it needs that specific tree to have fruit. And Rabbi Yosef Frank is saying, maybe not. Sorry, not maybe not. Maybe he's going the other way. He's saying maybe, yeah, it needs to have fruit, and maybe needing to have fruit doesn't yet make it a fruit tree, which I think I personally think is maybe a little bit of a stretch, but that's the way it is. But he says if you plant a tree like this, a canary palm, as a border on a property, and that's so your purpose of it is to make clear the boundary line between your property and the other property, so then halakhically it's clearly not a fruit tree, because you don't need the fruit, you don't want the fruit, you don't care about the fruit, that's not your purpose. Your purpose is just that it be there on the border so that people know where the end of your property is. So if Tzibas Frank says, nonetheless, he thinks we'd be allowed to use the lulavim from it because it happens to have dates growing on it. So he's saying he doesn't think the purpose of growing it is necessary, that as long as it has fruit growing on it, then it can be qualified as being kapot marim, and therefore you're okay. And therefore, he too sides with Madani Yom Tov, and he thinks Madani Yom Tov is more correct. That while it's true that an etrog tree is going to necessarily be obligated in Orla, because in the case of an etrog tree, you clearly need the fruit for themselves, in and of themselves, even though it's for its mitzvah purpose, not for an eating purpose, but you need the fruit, then it's obviously a fruit tree. With lulavim, it seems not to be true, because lulavim, it may be that you require those lulavim to have dates on them. Rav Zifrani is going to argue that maybe you don't need them to have dates on them at all. But even if you did need them to have dates on them, that's not germane. That doesn't make it a fruit tree. That's just sort of a condition in being able to take the lulavim off of it. But he shows, as an example, if you planted a tree, ordinarily you plant a tree, forget the lulavim part, you plant these kinds of trees for the purpose of being the border, so that's sort of like planting it for its etzim. He assumes that you could clearly also use the lulavim because it has dates in it, and that's why it's not subject to the laws of Orla. So that doesn't get us to the question of whether or not these trees are canary date palms, or yet with their poor versions of dates, whether they're yet going to be able to use the lulav. He just pointed out that the Orla discussion and the question of whether it has to have dates or not in order to be a lulav tree is not quite as germane, as not quite as relevant as we wanted in this. Now, I will point out that I didn't just come with my own ideas about this. I was kind of interested in Madani Yom Tov's willingness to oppose the Rosh, and Shulchan Aruch also followed the Rosh. So the Aruch HaShulchan in Yerideya 294.41 mentions this Madani Yom Tov, but the Aruch HaShulchan argues that once you plant a tree for the purpose of fulfilling a mitzvah, that's what's called, it's like called achshave. You give an importance to this tree. So that importance you give to the tree, meaning it's really a tree you're planting for the wood and the branches. So if I'm planting for the wood and the branches, meaning I want to make fires out of them, I need firewood, we usually think of that as therefore the fruit is completely irrelevant. Or if I'm planting it for a border, as Rabbi Frank mentioned earlier, then also we say you don't really care about the tree, you just want something like a fence, so it's not really for the purpose of the tree. But when you plant it in order to grow, so therefore, theoretically, if it had dates on it and you decided to take the branches off it, that would qualify, even though it wouldn't be obligated in Orla. But the Aruch HaShulchan said, when you plant a tree for the purpose of the mitzvah, then you're making it a tamarim tree. It's true, these tamarim may or may not be the kind of tree you care about. You may or may not ever use the tamarim, the dates off the tree. But you've made it into a date tree, because that's what the halakhic definition of it, that's what the Torah definition of it is. You made it into a date tree. Once you made it into a date tree, it's a date tree for Orla purposes. So he seems to be saying that all you need to be chayav in Orla is an important plant. It's important because you want it for the palm branches, and it has fruit. Once it's an important plant that also has fruit, then it's obligated in Orla. Now, I think the Aruch HaShulchan's reading fits the language of the Rosh and the Shulchan Aruch, but you can look it up, because they spoke of planting it for the mitzvah. So the trees that tend to grow fruit are obligated in Orla, not only if they actually grow fruit, but also if they're when they're planted for themselves as trees, not necessarily as fruit trees, right? So a tree planted to be a border isn't really planted being a tree. It's just one version of how you get a fence. A tree planted for lumber isn't really planted to being a tree. It's planted to produce the end product. So there you could argue there's no Orla. That's why there's no Orla, because for the fact that it's a fruit tree, is not only is the fruit irrelevant, the treeness of it is irrelevant. But the Aruch HaShulchan is arguing, and I think he has good basis in the Rosh and the Shulchan Aruch for my own personal reading, that he needs me to agree with him. Trees that you plant to provide mitzvah items are there to be a tree, because this mitzvah item must come off of a tree. So it means you value it as a tree. It's true you don't actually value the fruit, but it's got to be that fruit kind of a tree in order for you to be able to get the mitzvah off of it. So therefore, you're valuing it as a tree, and it's a fruit tree. And any tree that grows fruit and is valued as a tree is going to be subject to Orla. Now, Rav Zilber Frank doesn't mention the Aruch HaShulchan, so I can't know what he would have responded to it. Right? He may have disagreed vigorously for reasons I don't know. And I don't know if Rav Zilber Frank, you know, read the Shulchan or the Aruch HaShulchan regularly, but that's where that discussion seems to stand. So now let's go back to the canary palm. And after that discussion, when he comes back to the issue, he now treats it, and he comes to sort of realize, he must have known it begins with, but he comes to take seriously the fact that this is a whole type of palm, and this whole type of palm doesn't actually grow dates. It's not really, it's not a happenstance version of the palm that does grow dates. It's a palm that doesn't grow dates. So he takes that seriously, and he relates it to the debate about aravot. So aravot are willow branches, and the Torah calls them, the aravot that we need for the mitzvah, arvei nachal. Arvei nachal literally means aravot, right, willows or whatever, that of the river. Now, Rashi and the Rif seem to understand the Gemara in Sukkah and Lamed Gimel to mean that we actually prefer aravot that grow by a river, that we want that to be one of the qualifying elements of the Arava we use on Sukkot. We want Arve Nachal. That's what we prefer. Whether or not other kinds of Arava could be kosher b'di'evit, if we use them, whether they qualify, or if we only have that, if they qualify, that's a discussion. But the Rashi and the Rif seem to think that we should search for and strive for Aravot that actually grow by the river. The Rambam and the Rosh think it's not true. They say that's a type question. You want it of the type that grew by the river, even if this particular Arava grew away from the river. There are other types of Aravot that never grow by the river, and those would be a problem. Names might not be, there's whole discussions about which are, which are not. Those might not be valid to qualify as Aravot. If it's true of Aravot, though, that you want the type that grows the river, so then, says Frank, what makes sense that lulav trees don't need to actually grow dates. They need to be of a type that need to tend to grow dates. There's Chatzim Sofer on his Kiddushim before. We're talking about Chatzim Sofer, I think, in the Tshuvot. But anyway, here in his Kiddushim, his Novella, his commentary on Sukkah 34b, Lamed Dalet Amid Bet, says exactly that. In his area, so the Chatzim Sofer said, in his area, people waved branches of trees that did not themselves, if the trees didn't bear fruit, as long as they were known as palms, because then they were the type of tree that would begin to bear such fruit. So I would say that I think the Chatzim Sofer lived in an area of Europe where it was very difficult to get lulav and sukkah in general, but that might have helped people's decision on what to do. But Rav Tzvi Zalman quotes that. Now, again, nowhere in the Tshuva that I remember does Rav Tzvi Zalman question whether canary palm is actually a date palm or not, meaning it's a type that never grows dates, but he seems to feel comfortable saying that no, but it's a date palm. It's a date palm, even though these particular trees don't grow fruit, they're of a type that does, and if they're of a type of does, we can wave them on Sukkot. So we might wonder about that response because of our understanding of how canary palms work. But whatever it is, he's enlightened us on matters of trees and fruits and what we do or don't wave on Sukkot. He tells us about tefillin and the types of animals that we can use for that. And for all the purposes, the question of what kinds of fruit, what kinds of trees we need to use or don't use in those situations. So that's all that we've been helped by Rav Tzvi Bissel Frank in this situation in Tshuvat Har Tzvi or Chaim Bet Kuf Yud Chet of the response before the 5th of Tishrei. Okay, so since that Tshuva did not take us hour, half hour, you know, years ago I used to do the Nachyomi for the OU, another important, valuable learning project that the OU did that I was very privileged to be part of, the Nachyomi, and they went through different Magidei Shir, different people giving Shirim, but they went through all of Nach, and so you can, if you start with the Nachyomi, you can start on your own time, you can start with their time, you can go through all of Nach, I think in 2 years? I think it's a chapter day, I think it's about 2 years. So every so often I would meet somebody and they would hear my name and they would say, oh, I hear you on the Nachyomi, and they would say something. So usually it was a nice thing. But one guy said to me, I don't remember his name anymore, he said to me, I want to say I enjoy your Shirim a lot. They're very good. But you need to know, you don't have to fill the whole half hour if you don't want to, which I thought was funny. So I don't know if you care about me filling the whole half hour. I sort of feel like a responsibility. Like if you come for a half hour, if you're learning in your day, I should give you a half hour. I'm not going to give you the full half hour today. But I think we can get in a quick, short response of the Binyan Tzion of Yaakov Entlinger. Also from the 5th of Tishrei, but this is from Tuf Resh Yud Dalet from 1854. And the rabbi of Oberdorf had written him a question, which we'll get to in a second, but it's a reminder that in Jewish history, there were all these people who were rabban, who were Talmidei Chachamim, Torah scholars, who were dedicated, and we don't really know very much about them, right? They don't make it into the books of history to know so much about them when they were perfectly fine Jews, as far as we know, and perfectly fine Torah scholars or whatever. So this Torah scholar, this rabbi, his name is Rabbi Gavriel Adler, a Kohen. I will point out that I bet somebody's going to email me. My email is grothst@gmail.com telling me, oh, what are you talking about? He was, of course, a great Torah scholar, but here's the information you can find out about if you only looked a little bit. So I look forward to being shown up, as I often have been in the past. So he asked the following question. He was a Kohen. That's relevant because the Taz in Or Chaim Simon Kuf Chaf Chet had raised the following point. The Ramah had ruled there that you're not allowed to use a Kohen for your own purpose, meaning you're not allowed to have a Kohen just do work for you and sort of enslave the Kohen, as it were, or have the Kohen be your servant. The reason was, even nowadays, it's considered kimoel behektish. It's considered like you're misusing hektish. Kohanim, for all that we don't have a temple today, we don't have a Beit HaMikdash today, Kohanim are functionaries of the Beit HaMikdash, and we're supposed to recognize them as such and think of them as such. We know that from the custom, which is based on a halacha d'oraita. It's not so much a custom, it's an expression of a Torah law, that if we're going to have somebody bench for the group, we ask the Kohen first, we let the Kohen go first, we're supposed to let the Kohen go first for various other things, take food first, and stuff like that. Then that's a pasuk of the Torah of a kidashto. We have to treat the Kohen as kadosh. The Rama says, well, if you're going to use the Kohen for your own purposes and make him do work for you, then that's a violation of that. Im lo machal al kach, unless the Kohen is willing to do it. Meaning, let's say I go to a Kohen's house and he says, no, please, I want to serve you lunch. Then I'm allowed to, this is what the Rama paskins, I'm allowed to let him serve me lunch because the Kohen has been mochel. Same way as, if you say to a Kohen, will you please lead us in benching? The Kohen says, no, please have so-and-so lead us in benching or let somebody else lead us in benching. Then you're allowed to do it. So there is an idea of mechila, of foregoing this honor. We owe the Kohen. But without that, we owe the Kohen the honor. That whole discussion is based on Hagos Mordechai, who tells a story about a Kohen who washed Rabbeinu Tam's hands. And a certain student was sitting there, and he said, I don't understand, there's a Yerushalmi that says, if you use a Kohen, then it's Me'ila. Then it's a violation, it's an improper use of sanctified things. So Rabbeinu Tam says, there is no Kedusha, this is an immediate response, no Kedusha nowadays, because there's no Beit HaMikdash, and the Torah says, and the Gemara says elsewhere, that the full sanctity of a Kohen only applies when they are wearing their Bigdei Kehuna. So, since Kohanim today don't have Bigdei Kehuna, they don't have the priestly vestment, the priestly clothing, then they're not full Kohanim in the sense of not being able to use them. So that's what the Rabbeinu Tam's immediate response was. So the student says, well, if that's true, then why do we have them lead benching first? So Rabbeinu Tam didn't have an answer right away. You have to think about it. We don't have a record of what Rabbeinu Tam eventually came up with, but Rabbeinu Peter, who's a Baal Tosfos, whose name was Peter, which is kind of interesting because Peter is really become very much known as a Christian name, but Rabbeinu Peter said, no, he has Kedusha, but he's able to be mochel his Kedusha. He's able to forego his sanctity, forego his high level. How do we know that? Because there's a Gemara in Kedushin that says that an Eved Ivri Kohen, if you have a Kohen who gets sold into slavery, is not nirtza, is not, so let's remember, when it comes to Jewish people, Jewish men who become indentured servants to other Jews. There's two ways that can happen. One way that can happen is they become so impoverished they need to, and then they sell themselves. That kind of a person will never have ritziata ozu, will never have their ear pierced, because they'll sell themselves for a certain number of years, they'll serve that certain number of years, and they leave. But there's another kind of a Jew who steals something, is unable to pay back what he stole, whom the court will sell into indentured servitude, and that person is sold for only 6 years, but if at the end of the 6 years, he is, in the meantime, married a non-Jewish woman, which you're allowed to do when you're an indentured servant. He's married a non-Jewish woman, and he says, I don't want to leave my wife, I don't want to leave my master, I love everybody. So the luck in the Torah is, you pierce his ear, not in the lobe, you pierce the ear itself, and then he stays a servant, an indentured servant, until the next Yovel, until the next Jubilee year. The Gemara in Kedushin says that you wouldn't do that to a Kohen because that renders him a Baal Mum. That renders the Kohen somebody with the kind of a disfigurement that the Torah says that they can't then offer korbanot, offer sacrifice in the temple. It sounds like, though, this is what Rabbeinu Peter's reasoning was. It sounds like, though, other than that, you could have. So how can you? You're not allowed to make use of Kohanim. So it seems like if a Kohen foregoes his honor, then you're able to make use of. So the Taz didn't understand because the Taz says, it's not up to him. We have another Gemara that tells us, V'kidashto, that pasuk that tells us we have to treat him as special, is Baal Korcho, even if the Kohen doesn't want to. So an example is, if a Kohen marries a Gerusha, marries a woman he's not allowed to marry, such as a divorced woman, we make them split up. And if the Kohen says, you know what, I want to give up my kahuna, he's not allowed to. So the Taz says, how can you tell me that he's allowed to give it up? I can tell you, show you he's not allowed to give it up. And the source verse is the same verse of V'kidashto, that he has to treat himself as kadosh, as special in a way, and we have to treat him as special in a way, and we have to impose that on him if he tries to refuse. How could it be that he could say, but I'm willing to be an Eved Ivri, I'm willing to be an indentured servant, a Jew who's an indentured servant to another Jew? So the Taz's answer was, it depends on whether the Kohen is getting actual benefit from it or not. In the case of the Gerusha, of the divorcee, he's not allowed, the divorcee said specifically he's not allowed to. But in other things, if he's getting benefit from it, so that would be things like serving somebody else or becoming an indentured servant to pay off his debt from the item that he stole. So since he's getting benefit from it, that's why he's allowed to do it. That's what the Taz had said. So this Rav from Oberdorf, Aberdorf, asked the Ben Yetzir of Yaakov Ettinger, based on a Hagos Maimoni, but he's expanding the question, but I understand when you sell somebody into servitude, Right? That's what he said. It's he stole something and he gets sold in servitude to pay it off. That's machru beit din. There's no mechila by him. He might not want to be sold into slavery. He just stole something and needs to pay off, so we sell him. So how could that be a mechila? And how could that be hana? How could that be he's getting benefit from it? So how are you allowed to buy a kohen as an indentured servant from the beit din who's being sold for his gneva? So if Yaakov Edlinger's basic answer is no, because the paying off of his loan is hana to him. It's a benefit to him. It's a benefit to him. Then he can do it. Then you might say to me, but it's not a benefit because the Gemara Nedarim, just thing to know, this is part of why it shows that knowing Shas is really very vital to being able to be a posek in any way. He says the Gemara Nedarim does say that, let's suppose, however it happens, two people have taken an oath not to get benefit from each other, or one person takes an oath not to get benefit from somebody, that other person is allowed to pay off his loans because that's not considered, it's not considered a hana. So that's odd, because we just said it is hana. So if you look at the Gemara there, that's a different case. That's where the creditor was never going to be able to sue the borrower anyway. So since the borrower was not on the hook for that particular loan, that's why you could pay it off. But things that you're on the hook for, such as if you steal something, you haven't paid it back, you're on the hook for it forever if they don't sell you into indentured servitude, and then maybe you don't want to be on the hook. So that's the hana that you get. And that therefore answers the question. So fundamentally, we come to the answer that for all the Rabbeinu Tam's instincts were that we don't treat Kohanim as Kedoshim today. Turns out that we do. We do think of them as Kedoshim. We do think we have an obligation to treat them as special, and therefore not to make use of them and not to use them for our own purposes unless they're mochel. Now, in most cases, wherever it would come up, they've already been mochel, and therefore we think that therefore going there on works for the reasons that we've just spoken about, and that's what you have. So that's a short response from Rabbi Yaakov Edlinger. Two responses on the 5th of Tishrei, canary palms as lulavim for the purpose of Sukkot, that's the Tzibis Frankenhart Tzvi, and the Binyan Tzion about the status of Kohanim in our times. Have a great day.